comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being
from
here
sea to shining sea
at the Kevin Smith Show.
And
we'll see if we can get that fixed. That's part of what I've got to tell you about here tonight, and I will in just a moment. We're here because you have a right to know and because you matter. Okay, now let me tell you what I've got to tell you. I've spent all weekend dealing with a rather severe attack on our web servers. Not all of the web servers, just one. It's been very, very, very intense. It's been hairy. I was working on it right up until 22 minutes into the previous hour. I'm not sure I have everything fixed, but all through the weekend, some of you, especially members, were noticing that there were things that wouldn't work. At times they could log in, at times they couldn't log in, and that's because I was having to rework it all and reconnect some of the software with the databases and so forth. We had to change a lot of different passwords and all kinds of things because of this attack on the web server. I was not the only one hit. I have received email from at least, I know of three other websites that deal with sort of this genre of information that got hit over this past weekend, and so apparently there's someone out there that has decided that people like me, who talk about things like I talk about, need to be quiet. And as you see, that did not work. I am here, and I am not quiet. Quiet has never been really one of my virtues, especially when somebody tries to make me be quiet. Ask me and maybe try to make me. Never gonna happen. Never gonna happen. Anyway, we're here. We have a free weekly newsletter, and I really encourage you to subscribe to that if you haven't already, because it's good. It's a good newsletter. And it's been around since 2000. It's been around for 11 years. Some of the people subscribing to our newsletter have been subscribers since 2000. So it must be okay. They stick with us. And we'd love to have you in the group, too. And by the way, it's free. Did I mention that? Oh, yes, I did. But if you forget, it's free. So all you have to do is go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, click where you see the big word that says K-Files right in the middle of your screen. You can't miss it. And in a few seconds, you can be subscribed. You'll get a confirmation email. It has a link in it you have to use to activate your subscription. And once you do that, once you've activated it, then you are subscribed. All right, we're going to step away for just a couple of minutes. We'll be back right after this. Welcome welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And we're still trying to get things set back like they were so everybody can hear us. As I was saying at the top of the show, it's been an intense attack all weekend against the Kevin Smith Show website and some others that are in our genre that also had some severe attacks. I will tell you this. What they were trying to do was log in as me, and in one-hour period, there were 77,000 attempts to log in as me in the control panel so that they could really mess things up. They didn't make it. We're still here. We're still standing. Messed up a few things because we had to change a few passwords. Well, when we change those passwords, then we have to go in and change all the software to reflect those new passwords. It's not just one password either. Okay, enough of that. As I said, we're here, we're still standing, and that's the way it's supposed to be. My guest this evening is someone who has been known in the UFO enthusiast community for a long time and in the paranormal enthusiast community for quite a long time. He is a prolific writer and publisher. His name is Timothy Green Beckley. Timothy, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, Kevin, very good to be on with you. And, you know, did you ever think that maybe some of those 77 emails there or whatever got into your system, maybe that was you trying to contact your website from alternate realities?
No, because I would have known the password. It's 77,000.
77,000. Well, there's a lot of different dimension, a lot of different dimensions out there, and I'm sure we'll cover a few of them tonight.
Timothy, you have a new book out, your latest book. We want to talk about that before this show is over, but you have just spent a month in near my old stomping grounds. You were out in Arizona at a place called Jerome. And, folks, Jerome, Arizona is not a big city. And I'll let Timothy describe for us Jerome, Arizona. But, the figures, the population figures you told me.
Yes.
It has grown since 2000.
Now the actual population of the city, as far as the living goes, is around 444. The ghosts outnumber the living probably by about 5 to 1, if not more than that.
Yeah, well, you see, in 2000, their population was 339. So they've grown.
That's a big jump. Well, commerce goes on, and it's an interesting place, as I guess you would agree. Jerome was once known as the wickedest city in the West. Now, that might be shooting the gun a bit, but it's an interesting town by all means.
Mm-hmm.
Over a period of 50 years, the population indeed came and went and came and back again. Basically, it's a mining town, copper being the main ingredient being taken out of the ground, mineral taken out of the ground, and then gold. And this goes back to around 1560, when the Spanish conquistadors went through the Verde Valley. And they were in the search, apparently, of 7 buried cities of gold that had been left behind, a couple of hundred years earlier, supposedly, this is according to legend, by the Knights Templar. Well, now the Knights Templar get around, and they certainly have buried their gold everywhere from Verde Valley up to Oak Island. So it's a curious story. I don't know if I put too much faith in that part of the legend, but it is an interesting story. Supposedly, the Spanish conquistadors walked through the valley with their armament on and their helmets and all for the grace of the king of Spain. Now, I don't know how much one could adore a king, but I don't think, Kevin, that neither you or I would want to walk through there with heavy armament and helmet on. I mean, sometimes, as you can attest to, out there in Arizona around Tucson and Jerome, the temperature can hit well into the hundreds, low hundreds, probably by the time you get up in the morning. So,
listen, I've been there when it was 121 or 122.
Well, let me.
No, I was there at 121. Yeah.
Driving up to Jerome, it's quite a high altitude, probably around 5,000 feet. Part of the city is. Part of the city is a little lower down because it slipped. Over a period of time, some of the dwellings started to slide down the side of the mountain. In fact, the jail, if you were a prisoner at one point, they would have to take it down the side of the mountain because the jail is down probably around 300 or 400 feet below normal street level, the main street level.
Yeah, I saw a picture of that.
The town was first, built up, inhabited around, I think 1870 or 1865 or so. That's when the first drove of prospectors landed in the area. And, a lot of them, of course, being a prospector is no easy job. You've got to move mountains, literally. So a lot of them decided, instead of prospecting for themselves, they would take jobs with the local mining company. And I think at one point there were probably around maybe four or five mines that were activated in and around Jerome. And everything was legal in Jerome, from gambling. There were gambling houses, bordellos, all-night bars. In fact, there were numerous shootouts and knifings and fires. Over a period of about 30 or 40 years, Jerome was almost burnt to the ground maybe about six or seven times. In fact, the editor of the local newspaper, which of course doesn't exist anymore, once said that he always had type ready for the front page headline, which says, "Jerome burns again." So it has quite a history and quite a wild one. And the ghosts are very active in Jerome. Probably more so, I would say, than in any other town in the West. Now, you hear stories of haunted hotels and other older dwellings all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in fact, there's so many shows on TV now, you can just thumb through them, one station to another. And there's always some asylum or hotel that's where the ghost hunters are going down some darkened hallway looking for some specter to pop out at them. And I kind of take such programs, I'm sure a lot of your listeners do, being very educated on the subject, with a huge grain of salt. But indeed, something peculiar is going on in Jerome.
Why? Okay, now you said that, number one, the population of ghosts outnumbers the living population. And secondly, you said it was known as the wickedest town in the West. Okay. Why is Jerome so ghostly? Why is there?
According to those now, there's a fellow there who is with the Jerome Historical Society, and he also runs the local ghost tours. A matter of the violent deaths, I guess, that have taken place in the town. Also, too, many of the people who live there, especially the miners, had a very, very hard time. I mean, outside of the bosses and the middle level people that worked at the mines, they worked in the mine. Maybe their shift was probably 8 to 10 hours a day. They would get out, they wanted some release, so they'd go and drinking. There were more towns, more restaurants, more bordellos in town than anything else. And, of course, boarding houses. And, in fact, the place that I stayed in, which was the Jerome Ghost Inn, it's been standing since around, I think, about 1885. And numerous ghosts are actually supposedly seen and heard and felt there. Each of the rooms has a diary or a ledger. Guests that have stayed in the particular suite will leave their experiences. And so I stayed in the miner's suite, which is a very nice room. It's a bed and breakfast now, which is open to the public. And I think there's only six or seven rooms in it, but each of them has a very unique presence. And just thumbing through the ledger that's in the room, I mean, I've got an article coming out in a very slick magazine that's published over in England called Paranormal. It'll be out in a few months. It's available at Barnes & Noble here. And it goes into great detail. I actually copied down some of the notes that have been left in the ledger over a period of probably about a decade. And it talks about people... you know, who's the covers, they felt the covers being pulled off them at night. They saw the presence of someone standing in the doorway. The woman who owns the bed and breakfast, in fact, has an unusual experience. Now, her husband is the chief of police in Jerome. So I don't think she's pulling our leg here. And the ledger in the room that I saw attests to some... phantoms, obviously, being afoot there. But she tells the experience of one day she was vacuuming upstairs on the second floor. And she was going down the hallway, and everybody, all the guests had checked out of the bed and breakfast. They had checked out of the inn. And she sees someone in the attire of a cowboy with a cowboy hat and dusty cowboy chaps. And he's kind of standing in the bathroom in the hallway, kind of standing in the door, you know, not halfway in, halfway out. And she says to him, you know, the bathrooms are only for guests, you'll have to leave. Well, with that, he kind of moves sideways into the restroom altogether, and she goes to, you know, to follow him, to tell him again that he has to get out of the hotel because she's busy cleaning. Well, she saw into the bathroom, and he's standing there in the cowboy attire, and suddenly he just dematerializes in front of her. So she races to the phone, and I don't know if they have 111 in Jerome, but her husband answers the phone, and she said, you know, there's somebody here, and I'm kind of, you know, afraid. I'm alone in the inn, and there was somebody here, and I don't know whether he's hiding or he's just disappeared on me or what. So the chief of the police, or he sends over a deputy, I think, and they investigate. They look at all the rooms, and there's nobody there. And apparently, other guests have seen this cowboy in chaps as well. And supposedly, one of the guests that stayed there had the opportunity to actually communicate with this ghostly cowboy. And apparently, the cowboy wanted to tell him and anybody who would listen that he had been murdered in the town, and he named the person who was his executioner, or who killed him, you know. In fact, this is one of the things that I found. The ghosts were very willing to communicate. All of them, I don't claim to be a medium or anything, Kevin, but I do have some psychic ability, and I was the founder of the New York School of Occult Arts and Sciences, and I've had a lot of paranormal things that have happened to me over the years, so maybe I'm just a little bit more tuned in than some people. But I had the distinct impression that everyone there, spirit-wise at least, had a story to tell, and basically they wanted to communicate with the with people that are on this side of the veil.
All right, now, you know, I understand that... there's this diary, and you know, where people are journal, where people record what's happened to them.
There's a ledger in each of the suites, right?
Mm-hmm. I understand, but now overall, throughout Jerome, how much of the paranormal activity is real paranormal activity, and how much of it is tourism marketing?
Well, you know, I didn't get the feeling. I only spent a couple of days there. I didn't spend the month. From talking to the people, and I did quite a few hours on the telephone, you know, as a backup research on this. Of course, you can't really tell. You know, I did a book quite a few years ago called "The UFOs Among the Stars," where celebrities told of their UFO experiences, and you know, you can't rate them in the same class as you would a pilot or a sheriff's deputy or a police officer or even someone on the street because they are actors and actresses. And I remember recently William Shatner had told me an experience backstage at the $10,000 Pyramid. It was a show that Dick Clark had on many, many years ago.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still in syndication now. And he told the story about how he was on his motorcycle going across through Death Valley, and his motorbike conked out, and it was over 100 degrees, and there was no shade, and he looked up, and there was this, after having passed out for a few minutes, so he looked up, and there was this silvery, shining object in the sky, and he couldn't get his motorbike to start, but somehow the UFO seemed to have drawn him to safety. So people have always asked me, well, do you believe that story? And I said, well, you know, I was reporting it for one of the, interviewing him for one of the tabloids. So what can I say? If somebody tells you a story, especially a celebrity like that, and your job is to report it, well, that's what I did. Well, recently, good old Bill was on a TV program, and he said, oh, I fooled the ufologist years and years ago. I made up this story, and I told him, and they believed me. I never said I believed him. I was just telling the story. And that's kind of my background, is that of a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were people in town who had detectors. And, you know, I'm not even sure exactly the principle by which they operate. But they were going off every two or three, minutes. In fact, I had got into one of the restaurants there, and I noticed something very peculiar about the balcony. I don't know, I sensed maybe a presence there or something. And I asked the waitress, I said, well, have you ever had any ghostly experiences? Because obviously that's why most people would come to the town of Jerome. And at first she wasn't particularly interested. I guess she had her mind on other things about, like, serving us and getting home, you know. But then she finally came back to the table and kind of sort of apologized, you know. She said, well, one of the other gals who works here, who's more into this, she sometimes senses something up on the balcony there, and she usually carries one of these ghost detectors with her, which lights up and flashes and everything, and sometimes it goes off when she's on the stairs there. I said, well, you know, I kind of felt the presence there, but, you know, I mean, maybe it was just my imagination because I'm looking for ghosts. Then she said, well, sometimes people try to get into the restroom, and they can't get in because it's locked from the inside. And I said to myself, Kevin, that doesn't sound like any big paranormal feat.
We have to step away for a break, and we'll pick up right there with that story when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More with Timothy Green Beckley right after this.
To the Kevin Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Timothy Green Beckley. And Tim, when we went away for break, you were telling us about the waitress said sometimes people try to go to the restroom, can't get in because it's locked from the inside. And just as you started to comment on that, we had to go to break.
Yeah, so I did an examination from the inside of the bathroom. Now, there was no window in the room. And it was a pretty good, heavy bolt lock. Not one of the little locks that you slide, but one that you turn. There was no space under the door. There wasn't any space on the side where you could jimmy it or use a credit card. So if she's telling the truth, I don't see, outside of Houdini being there, and that certainly would be a spirit, wouldn't it? Outside of Houdini being there in that particular restaurant, that would seem to be pretty much of a paranormal experience. No, I didn't. I did not feel as if. Certainly, I don't think people were telling me the stories, and I don't. There's a certain degree of wanting to keep, obviously, the legend alive. And we're talking about a town that had its periods of, population, and then the mines would close for a while, or the mines would dry up and people would go elsewhere. So we're talking about a period of probably close to 100 years. So obviously some of the records, since the town burnt, probably, like I say, 6 or 7 times, a lot of the records are missing. So there's probably a lot of detail that's hard to verify. There's no doubt about that. But I didn't get the impression that people were just making up stuff because there wasn't any reason to. So I came away. I came away with a feeling that there was a presence there in that town. And I'd like to go. I think I'm going to go back probably next summer and spend a little bit more time there. I usually pull into Tucson around June or so. My friend Alan Benz, who used to be the librarian for the APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, or at least he was associated with them. I think he was the capacity of the librarian. He has a little closed meeting or private conference, usually at one of the resorts there, and I speak at the group. I have probably, I would say, Tucson and Phoenix. I have more associates and friends I've developed over the years in the state of Arizona probably than anywhere else. I mean, that just seems to be where it's happening, and it has happened, of course, from the Phoenix Lights, on down. I'm good friends with Jim Delatoso, who, of course, has worked out of there for many, many years. I knew Wendell Stevens fairly well. In fact, I have the rights to a couple of Wendell's books that I purchased before he passed away. In fact, he passed away just before I had arrived in town a couple of months ago. Very sad, but I'm sure he's with us from the other side. In fact, I did an interview with his daughter while I was out there, Cece Stevens, and she told me, she said, when I was in the room interviewing her, she felt the presence of her dad around me. And Wendell and I had been fairly close associates over the years. We had swapped a lot of stories and information, and I always visited and chatted with him on the phone a couple times a year and did a couple of really lengthy interviews. So I spend a few weeks every year in the state of Arizona. It's one of the places that I enjoy being when I'm not at home, busy behind my computer.
Well, I'll tell you this, having lived in Arizona from the end of 2003 up until near the end of 2010, it is a hot spot, not just because of the weather. It is that, but it's a hot spot. There's a lot of UFO activity, and there's a lot of other paranormal type activity.
Oh. Well, I've spent a lot of time, of course, down in Sedona, and I had a rather unusual experience while I was down there. Not last time, but the time before. I'm very big into coincidence and synchronicities. I think I've told some of the stories on the air. I mean, things that are just, like, totally out of the norm that there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason for, but they happen, and that's the way it is. Anyway, one of the, I guess, the favorite meeting places down in Sedona, pretty close to Bell Rock, is the Coffee Pot, which is a place where you get 102 omelets or something like that, and everybody kind of gathers there for a breakfast or a late brunch or something, especially on the weekend. In fact, I've run into people there that they didn't even know I was going to be in town. Just happened to be there. And anyway, so I was there with my friend Charlotte, and we had had brunch. I guess it was a Saturday or Sunday afternoon. And I go up front to pay with my credit card, and I get the receipt, and I'm looking at the receipt, and I kind of just did a double take at it. The bill for the food and the tax came to 2012, and here I am a mile away from Bell Rock, where of course everybody probably will be gathering for the 2012. I think that's a little bit very unusual. At least I got a little kick out of it. I don't know what the secret meaning of it is, but stuff like that seems to happen all the time. In fact, also for Paranormal Magazine, I'm doing a little research on people in the paranormal and UFO community it seems that the people who are involved in this have a lot more coincidences and synchronicities in their life than the average person does. I don't know why that is exactly, but
well, do you think they actually? You think actually they have more? Are they just more attuned and noticing more?
Well, I would have to have a grant from some university or some organization to do a little more research on it. I think actually it is worth doing to see if that is the case or not. But almost everybody that I talk to seem to have had some sort of not just one, but several synchronicities. I know I've had literally dozens of them, and eventually in this article that I should finish in the next couple of weeks if I get a little break from putting together my conspiracy journal and a few other books I'm working on, I'm going to go through all the notes that I've made and all the interviews that I've done and see what conclusions I could reach. Now, you know, John C. Lilly, I don't know if you're familiar with the name or not, he did a, Dr. John C. Lilly, he did a book called, I think it was Eye of the Cyclone, many, many years ago. And he claimed, and I guess he had some scientific evidence to back this up, that he was actually able to communicate with dolphins. Remember when that was the rage going back, I guess, in the late 60s, early 70s. Well, he had a number of these synchronicities in his life, and he actually believed that there was some sort of, I don't know the best way to explain it, you could look this up on the internet, just type in his name, John C. Lilly, you know, but he thought that there was actually some invisible board or of entities or a group of masters or beings somewhere else, you know, in another dimension that we can't see, who are actually responsible for us or people in the field or people who are having these synchronicities and coincidences, that they were actually responsible for this as a way of letting us know of their existence, since they're not able to talk to us or pick up the telephone or anything along that line. It's sort of like a prompting experience. And I would have to say that I don't know the meaning of these synchronicities, but they are truly bizarre. And I think that there may be some intelligence. I would go along and say that there is some intelligence behind them. But, you know, I've kind of, over the years, come to the conclusion that things that happened in a seance room or in a haunted house or out in a field with a UFO are very closely akin. I think that the flying saucers and paranormal experiences, maybe not 100%, but for the most part, have a common bond or a common ground. I don't believe that we are being visited on a daily basis by extraterrestrial craft, and I know people like Richard Dolan and Stanton Friedman, who I greatly respect, would take a great issue with me, but having had a background in the paranormal, I think I am able to see and note a lot of things that just kind of pass them by. So I would say that, yeah, there could be a few visitors from afar every once in a while wandering into our atmosphere. But when you study all the data, it just doesn't make sense that there would be beings from outer space crossing the vast distances of time and space to come here and just, you know, be seen and maybe land in the desert or shake somebody's hand or have a telepathic experience with them. They just don't behave like interplanetary visitors would. It just seems whatever is happening here is a little bit outside of the norm. It's more than nuts and bolts. I think it's, to a large degree, paranormal in nature. And some of it is not very positive. I do believe that that there are beings that are coming here who are benevolent, that they have been watching us ever since the beginning of time. We might put them in the classification of like angelic beings, probably akin to things like the elementals, fairies, and so forth. There's a different levels of creation out there. In fact, in the Islamic faith, they talk about the jinn, which is their version of the supernatural being. So I think that we have other dimensions that open up to us and parallel realms and worlds, and that these beings are coming here, some by accident, some out of curiosity, probably some through their own device. I don't know exactly what their motives are, if exactly they even have a motive. I think it's an intelligence that we're dealing with that's different than ours. So you can't explain it in the same way that you would explain our consciousness or our intelligence. It's something totally different, and I think that they show themselves in different ways, means, and forms. And
all right, let me break in and change the subject just for a moment. Are you hearing every few seconds a little beep in the background?
No, I'm hearing a little bit of something that sounds like maybe a little static or rustling, but not a beep, no.
Well, you know, when someone is recording you, they have to either say they are recording you.
Oh, absolutely.
Or they have to give
absolutely,
you a beep
right.
tone.
Mm-hmm.
Listen very carefully for just a second. Did you hear that?
No, it's not. I think our audience,
folks, what this means is someone, for whatever crazy reason, has decided to tap the phone lines and record the show. I don't know why you would do that, Tim. When all you have to do, we're broadcasting to the whole world. All you have to do is just turn it on and turn your recorder on. But anyway. Folks, if you're members, you can get into the archives. You be sure you download that. Enhance the sound. You'll hear that beep in the background.
Huh.
So we are being recorded. To the morons doing it, welcome. this is out here where people are still, at least we're under the illusion we're free. And we still think. And we have real jobs. And I'd like to invite you guys to join the real world and get some real jobs. Okay, now, Tim, you think that a lot of what we... Well, we have a break coming up. You think that a lot of what we call UFO activity, and we think is UFO activity, you think perhaps these are living entities that maybe are kind of on the spiritual side of things. I think that's what you're saying, and we'll get to that when we come back from this break. So, folks, don't go away. Hang in there. Turn your recorders on and record them recording us. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Timothy Green Beckley. As we went to break, Timothy, I was saying, if I understand what you're saying correctly, is you think that a lot of the things that people see and think are UFOs actually are some type of a living entity.
Well, when you say living, now, there are some people who believe in the existence of what has been termed space animals or space creatures. Back in the early 1950s, there was a fellow, and I think he's still with us living in California. His name is Trevor James Constable.
He's been on the show.
Oh, wonderful. He's done some fascinating research into Wilhelm Reich and cloud-busting equipment, and you know they found when they aimed the cloud busters in certain spots in the sky, and they took photographs using I think he was using infrared film in those days. These giant, let's call them an amoeba, for lack of a better term, and I guess these were the forerunners in a sense of Jose Escamilla's. The creatures that he is able to photograph. Now, I don't, to me, they seem like space creatures. They are not if they do exist and these photographs are valid, and I see no reason to think that they were hoaxed, I don't believe that there is much of a consciousness or an intelligence behind them. They just seem to be wandering around like the orbs and the objects and all the Escamilla photographs that kind of look like a cigar craft or centipedes or some living creature, but they don't seem to be super intelligent. Now, what I'm referring to, and again, it's hard to put in words because I think we're dealing with a different intelligence than anything that we can think of. It's something beyond our grasp, so it's hard to describe. And I can't say that I have, discovered the secret of the universe, Kevin. And anybody who says that they have and theirs is the only answer, I think they're probably decisively, wrong, and probably are hoping to capture a little bit more of a gullible crowd. I'm still looking for the answers, but I think that there is something intelligent here that we can't identify. For example, there's a place in North Carolina called Brown Mountain. Now I hear the beep.
Yeah.
Very loud. So, there you go. Anyway, in North Carolina, in the mountains of North Carolina, there is a spot near the town of Morgan, I believe it is, where the Brown Mountain lights have been seen for centuries. Even the Indians tell of the stories. Where these phosphorescent lights come up out of the valley at a distance, but can actually even approach humans. And I've talked to a number of the witnesses down there. A friend of mine is a fellow by the name of Joshua Warren. He's probably the leading expert on the Brown Mountain Lights. He has a website devoted to the subject. He's been on the National Geographic Channel and everywhere.
You're talking about Joshua P. Warren?
Yeah, Joshua P. Warren.
Yeah, I know him.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Very astute gentleman when it comes to the paranormal. In fact, we kind of met under very strange synchronicity. We're both filmmakers. We make like low budget horror movies,
Mm-hmm.
So we were at a B movie film festival up outside the town of Syracuse. Now, mind you, it wasn't even in the town of Syracuse. It was outside the town somewhere, Very hard to get to. So here we are. It's in wedding reception hall. Very hard chairs. We're watching these films, some of which were not very exciting, to say the least. So every once in a while, we'd kind of wander out to the bar, have a beer, talk amongst ourselves. Well, now, neither Joshua had no idea who I was, and I, of course, at that time didn't know that he was probably the leading paranormal researcher in North Carolina, if not of the entire South down there, And then it turned out over a period of maybe about 5 or 6 months, we started corresponding, and we realized that not only did we share an interest in filmmaking, mm-hmm. but we also, of course, were very deeply involved in UFOs and the paranormal. And so Josh has investigated the Brown Mountain Lights, and he's actually videotaped the lights for the first time. But I spent some time down there with Alan Greenfield and Jim Mosley quite a number of years ago and talked to some of the witnesses that were still alive from like the 1920s and 30s and 40s when the lights were very, very active. And, they would describe how they would approach these lights that maybe were 30 or 40 feet away. And as they got closer and closer, the lights would dissolve in front of their eyes and just like poof, vanish, And they would turn around and they would be in back of them. And they would start going, facing the lights and going towards them. And the same thing would happen over and over again. The people there, interviewed, described to me something that was certainly a lot more intelligent than just an amoeba or an orb floating around in the atmosphere. It's something that seemed to know of our presence and something that seemed to know what we were thinking. And, in the majority of the UFO encounters, where people have close encounters or actual contact experiences, telepathy seems to play a very great part in their sightings and in their encounters. So I definitely think that there is a total hookup between the manifestation of what we call UFOs, which have the ability to shape shift. I think they possibly even have the ability to turn into this intelligence has the ability to turn into what appear to be metallic-looking craft, but they may not be physical objects whatsoever.
Now, interesting. I know that this is interesting. But you know, you were talking about this sort of psychic telepathic hookup.
Yes.
That should not be so difficult for anybody to sort of wrap their mind around, because we see evidence of that even with animals. I'll give you a quick example. Our producer is, he loves cats. And so his cat can roam his office, but I don't let the cat into my office, into my studio. But I like the cat. Good cat. And when he first arrived, he came over and put his, he stretched out and put his front paws up on my leg near my knee. And he started to put his claws in. You know how they like to pull on stuff?
Oh, yeah.
He started to put his claws into my jeans. And this is the first time, so he's never been conditioned to this. I said, no claws. And he pulled his claws back. I think, now there are people that will chuckle at that. They will say it's coincidence. Yeah. But I'll tell you, it happens every single time that cat starts to use his claws that way with me. I say, no claws. I don't yell at him. I say it just like that. No claws.
Well,
and he pulls them back. And I think they may not understand the language. They understand the intent.
Well, there, of course, we do know that animals have a great deal of sensitivity, perhaps a heightened, more heightened sense than humans do, before earthquakes or other disasters. They seem to have an inner sense or a warning, and will take flight from a particular area where disaster will surely take place. So there's no doubt that they do have a heightened sense of psychic ability or sensitivity. And I don't see why there can't be other living energies. Let's call it an energy. I think that's what I would rather call it than an entity. And you know what else I've concluded? You know, people say, we talk about like the contactee experiences. And in fact, I have an article coming out in I think the issue after next in Open Minds magazine, which has been around for a couple of years now, and. It's on, the subject is a fellow that I knew fairly well over the years.
You'll have to tell us about it when we come back from this break, Timothy. Ladies and gentlemen, we shall return right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Tim Beckley. Those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted you are here, and you have my sincere sympathy for whatever it is that kept you away for the first hour. But we are glad you're here now. Timothy Beckley is, of course, one of the most prolific writers and publishers in the field of the paranormal and UFOs in the genre in which this show swims. And we have had, I think, a fascinating first hour of information about primarily ghosts, but it's kind of switched now. We've kind of switched gears into talking about these, I call them entities. He's calling them energies. But whatever they are, non-material, that seem to be very, very intelligent and are making appearances in various forms around the world. Timothy, we're going to go just a few minutes here, and then we'll open up the telephone lines for our audience to participate. But let me share this with you and with the audience before we jump back in. During that break, two things happened. One, I made a few changes and adjustments here on the telephone system to see if we can lose the beep. It may not bother you, folks. You may hear it. You may not hear it. But I'm hearing it. And Timothy's hearing it. And it bothers me. So I don't know if we got rid of it, but we tried. The second thing that happened is I checked flash messages. And I had one from Greece wanting to know why I played that hard rock music. Why didn't I play something a little bit more new age?
Oh, I love the hard rock.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I play hard rock music, and this is a very deep, deep reason, folks. Are you ready? The reason I play hard rock music is because I like it. That's profound, isn't it? Very profound. Are you still with me, Timothy?
I am right here.
Okay, very good. I want to get into we're beginning to sort of get into the outskirts of your latest book about UFOs. This book, tell us the title of it.
Okay, well it's pretty long, but the main title is Round Trip to Hell in a Flying Saucer, and the subtitle is UFO Parasites, Alien Soul Suckers, and Invaders from Demonic Realms. Now, I collected and gathered the material, but there are other contributors to the work as well, people like Sean Castile and Scott Corrales, Adam Go-Rightly, Alan Greenfield, Brad Steiger, and so forth. We all got together, and, you know, it was just my thinking that, geez, you hear all these stories about the Sweetness and Light and Billy Meyer and friendly space beings, but anybody who's been in tune with the UFO field for any number of years can tell you for certain that there is another side of the coin. Whether we want to admit it or not, just like in this world, there are good guys and there are bad guys. And throughout the cosmos or other dimensions or what other realms we want to bring into this discussion, it seems to be the same thing. There are people who are visiting us, and I use just the word people for lack of a better term, because we could skirt around the issue for hours trying to come up with what we're exactly trying to define. But there are good energies, good intelligence, and there are those who are very negative and disposed to us in a very evil light. Now, we could look at this in biblical terms, but I'm not into the Bible. I think people use that as a crutch. I mean, you know, like people say, oh, I saw such and such a chapter in verse, and so it has to be true. Well, I'm not falling for that. I got to go out and I got to do my own research. But apparently, this battle has been going on through time since the beginning of time, and I think that whatever is here with us or alongside of us and normally invisible has been alongside and invisible to us since the creation. Now, whether there is a single God and God created all the intelligence in the universe, I don't know. I would doubt that myself, but I don't go for the Big Bang theory either. I think we could very well be someone else's experiment. We could be in a test tube floating around. We could be in the Matrix. If you want to go that far, there are some people who think that the movie was more than just fantasy. Whatever it may be, there is a body of evidence to indicate that there is something negative that is going on that has attached itself to this field. And we talk about Arizona being one of my favorite places and all the activity that goes on there. One of the incidences that I investigated many years ago, and it's written up in detail in Brett Steiger's new book on aliens and creatures. And you can Google that. I can't remember. I'm ashamed. I can't remember the exact title. But there was a fellow in Arizona. His name was Scott. And he was out, I guess, hiking through Superstition Mountains, and it was getting towards dusk. He was with a buddy of his, and all of a sudden the sky opened, and something sucked him and his friend up into the clouds. They found themselves inside of what appeared to be a vehicle of some sort, and they were in separate compartments or rooms, and met an intelligence or beings there who looked human, and were given a physical exam of some sort, which of course is very popular among people who maintain that they have had some sort of abduction experience. Scott had an ongoing series of events. I mean, this was just the beginning of the activity, the UFO activity that attached itself to him. His case was investigated by a university professor and other people with the scientific credentials. He was actually possessed, I guess. Now, more so than channeling. I mean, channeling is usually this lofty, flighty people who talk philosophically about the universe and how we should love each other and all. Well, Scott's experience was a lot deeper than that. Not only did he go into a trance-like state, but his voice actually changed. And they hooked him up to a device that can, monitor the rhythm of the voice. And they found out that it was a total difference between when he was speaking in his normal voice and when he was overcome or possessed by this entity. Now, most of the information that came to him was mathematical in nature, formulas and things. Now, this isn't uncommon. In fact, recently one of the military personnel who was involved in the Bentwaters case, mm-hmm. Jim Pennington, even has a notebook with all this binary code and stuff that he took down, apparently also, too, while he was channeling it or communicating with whoever was responsible for this craft that they encountered in the woods there in Wrangleson Forest. So not only was there this mechanical voice that took over Scott's presence, or vocal cords, but he had all these other doors opening. It was a whole range of a paranormal activity. In fact, there would be lightning bolts or streams of light that would appear in his house that was witnessed not only by him and his wife, other members of the family, also by neighbors and several investigators. One day he was sleeping in bed and or taking a nap, and this light actually caught the blanket on fire. And, there was all sorts of, and this is not unusual. I mean, many, many cases of people actually being overcome or possessed after they've had a UFO encounter. In fact, there's a case which I describe in the book, Round Trip to Hell and Flying Saucer, which you can get on Amazon. It is available in Kindle, or if you get to our website at conspiracyjournal.com, we could also give you a copy. In fact, we give a free DVD with most of our books because it's multimedia today. That's what we're into, not just publishing books, but also into doing videos and so forth. There was an incident that's described in the book that took place in Brazil back in the early 1960s, a coastal town where this object appeared several days in a row, was actually photographed. I think some of the photographs are in the book. And people in the town started going into a trance-like state and writing down information, and the people living in different parts of town who did not know each other, there was no, common ground, reported the same experience, and some of the notes or the automatic writing, I guess you could describe it as, were identical, why the space people were coming here and so forth and so on, and they had the photographs to back it up. Now, even the Navy, there were several members of the Navy who were involved in an experiment where they actually called down UFO entities. And they saw a craft, in fact, from their office window. And they got to the point where they were actually taking notes on this, and an admiral got involved in it, in the case. So it goes on and on where there is this polarizing effect. There's both good and there's both seems to be negative aspects of the phenomena that's going on. So I do warn the people, don't get overwhelmed by this. Don't be caught up by UFOs. You know, some people do, too, and I'm sure you realize that, Kevin. They have one or two sightings, and their whole life changes. Sometimes they even divorce their mates of many years. It's just the whole, they get just totally overwhelmed by this in a very negative sense. Where, on the other hand, some people do have, of course, positive experiences. But there is a negative aspect of this. And
there are
any number of cases where people's entire homes have been just taken over by this phenomenon. I remember a case in Colorado, which is mentioned in the book, where a fellow had all these light orbs and lights in streaks coming into the house and outside, and some really fabulous video that's posted on YouTube. It's in the Black Forest of Colorado. And finally, the phenomena became so overwhelming that he just had to flee. Him and his family just had to get out of there. Something was happening just every night. Not only just the light phenomena and the orbs in the house and outside in the woods, but also strange sounds and noises and just bizarre things, you know. Water going on and off and doors opening and closing and all the things that you would associate with poltergeist phenomena.
Well, one of the things, you mentioned how sometimes people just get overwhelmed with this, and that is true. Sometimes people do get overwhelmed with it, and I do know of cases where marriages have broken up because one person is just consumed with UFOs and extraterrestrials, and the other person is not interested, and it causes friction, it causes, you know, problems. And, you know, one of the things that I have told people, and I do get email from people who are distressed because their husband won't wake up from his sleep and realize, you know, his mental sleep, and realize that this is real. I get email, you know, from people who say that, you know, my wife refuses to wake up, and, you know, it's causing problems. Look, this is like, you know, one person likes shrimp and the other one likes beef. That's what freedom's about. One person in the family who is awake and the other person is not awake. So, I mean, that happens physically, doesn't it? I mean, think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning one morning and your husband's still asleep. Or vice versa. You get up, make a cup of coffee. Do you get up, make a cup of coffee, and call a divorce lawyer because your husband's still asleep? No. So, you know, it really, there's no reason for this stuff to cause these kinds of problems. It doesn't matter if someone is awake or they're not awake. In the long, broad stroke of the brush, it doesn't matter, because whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Whether you're awake or not awake, whatever is going to be is going to be. And there's no reason for people to get sideways with each other over it.
Well, UFOs have been quite a big stumbling block in people's lives when it comes to relationships and the paranormal as well. Now, I had an association going back, of course, long before email. We would, correspond and send long letters and tapes, cassette, even before cassette tapes. There were little miniature reel-to-reel tapes, you know. And we all had like a chain letter. You'd record maybe 10 minutes, and then you'd send it on to someone else, and they would record their sentiments on a subject and send it around and so forth, kind of like a round robin on tape. One of the fellows that I had a pretty good working relationship with was Brinsley Lepore Trench. Now, Brinsley Lepore Trench was a writer on ancient astronauts even before Eric Van Daniken. He wrote a book, I think it was published around 1962 or 63, called The Sky People. He was a British writer, And he also became, after the passing of his brother, he became the eighth Earl of Clancarty. He was a member of the British House of Lords. And he had organized a UFO, kind of like a subcommittee or private group. It had no official jurisdiction, but there were about 40 or 50 members, all of whom were members of the House of Lords or of Parliament. The Parliament is, of course, the elected officials, and the House of Lords are the hereditary, you know, the earls and so forth, who take their position in seats going back, I guess, centuries. And Brinsley had a keen interest in UFOs, and in the his beliefs. Now, he was a strong advocate. Well, he first started out as a believer in the interplanetary theory, which says that we're being visited from other star systems, or maybe even from UFOs who have bases on the far side of the moon, or even on the visible side of the moon, or on Mars, perhaps even in the undersea bases here, or in the mountain caverns. But then, little by little, just like most ufologists, or certainly a number of them, he began to see that probably the folly of the nature of believing that all these things are from outer space. Now, he took a liking to the inner Earth theory. He believed that some of the craft that were being seen were actually craft that were coming back and were related, or the ancestors were those that had lived on the continents, the lost continents of Atlantis and Mu, and some of them have apparently even moved inside the Earth. He believed that there were colonies and actual cities inside our own planet. And, of course, he was kind of the brunt of a little bit of ridicule there, because that's kind of a difficult theory to accept, although I think there certainly may be something to it. Anyway, he organized this UFO group that and invited the speakers to come over to England at their own expense and speak to this group on their UFO activities and investigations. And in the early 1980s, he invited me to speak. So I spoke before this group in a private session, told them about my own UFO experiences and some of the sightings that they may not have been aware of, involving pilots here and military officials and so forth. And I think the talk was fairly well received. And after it was about an hour conversation, kind of more of a chat than anything else, you know, we had the opportunity, or I had the opportunity, to meet some of the members of the Parliament of the House of Lords who were interested in the subject. There were a few skeptics aboard, but most of them were believers. Now, one of the gentlemen that I got to meet was Lord Hill Norton. He was a five-star general and the former head of the British Ministry of Defense. And he was a strong believer in the existence of UFOs, but he didn't see them in a positive light. Instead, in the private conversation that we had, and this has also been printed, he was very concerned about UFOs because he thought that there might be a negative tinge to them. In fact, he said, this is a quote that is in the book, he said, UFOs are essentially a religious matter rather than a military threat. And furthermore, there is certainly a degree of psychic involvement in almost every case. And he also realized, too, that this was a great problem area with a lot of Christians, especially born-again Christians. Now, when we talk about a round trip to hell in a flying saucer, there's actually a manuscript in the book that was privately published in the early 1950s, and it's part of the book. We use the entire text. It's not very long. It's maybe 60 or 70 pages. About a gentleman who was an auto mechanic living in California. And, of course, California was the spot where it seems about everybody was having a UFO contact experience back around the late 40s and early 50s. Anyway, this fellow ran an auto mechanic repair shop. And one day, two gentlemen come in, and see, there seems to be something very unusual about them. They have an automobile that's giving them some problems, but in the course of the conversation, they tell this repair guy who's running the auto repair place that they're from another planet. And he said, "Oh my goodness!" That, you know, he said to himself, "Well, that sounds ridiculous. You know, prove it to me if you can." And directly in front of his eyes, they vanished. They became transparent, and poof, they were gone. And a couple minutes later, they were visible again. And he apparently had a. They offered to take him for a ride. You know, he insisted he wanted to go out for a ride in their craft. And they warned him that it would not be a pleasant experience. So whether through physical means or out-of-the-body travel, astral projection, whatever you want to call it, he ended up going to this place, or planet, whatever you want to call it, where Satan supposedly resigned. And he said he actually saw, I don't know whether it's a hallucinatory experience or whether this really took place, but he said that he actually saw like a sea of lava on which coffins were floating, and he sat down and had a conversation with this demonic or satanic type being. It's a certainly probably one of the most unusual stories I've ever read in UFO literature. But it's told totally with a very straight face and with a lot of detail.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing, though.
Yes.
Lord Hale Norton makes the comment that UFOs are essentially a religious matter.
Yes.
And then here's a guy who obviously is attaching some religious beliefs.
Yes. Well, there are a lot of people who do.
I don't think UFOs are religious at all.
Well, but they can be interpreted in that sense. And a lot.
Well, you can interpret doorknobs that way too.
Yes, you can.
And that's my point. If they exist, they just exist. And if they don't, they just don't. And you know, if I believe 10 billion% that UFOs exist. If they really don't exist, they will not begin to exist just because I believe it. If I don't believe in them and they really do exist, my disbelief will not cause them to no longer exist. They will continue to exist. And so I think our belief and our disbelief really... I think that needs to be kicked to the curb.
Well, you know, people down throughout history, Kevin, have had experiences that they...
You know, it's not fair, because every time you start to respond, the break takes over. I promise you, these are automated breaks. I'm not doing it. But I'm going to let you respond to that when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away.
Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada. When a topic in history or science or the paranormal is too outre or controversial for conventional media, where can we go for information? To the Kevin Smith Show, of course. I'm a big fan.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Timothy Beckley. Tim, I had just made the comment that I think we need to kick the religious factors when we're talking about UFOs, just kick that completely to the curb, because, I mean, you can make something religious out of doorknobs. I just don't think that UFOs demand belief. Either they exist or they don't. You had started to respond and the break took over. I want to give you the chance to respond.
Well, you know, see, my whole thing on this, and this is, I think, where a lot of people involved in the field just kind of don't get it, is that UFOs are kind of like investigating UFOs are kind of like investing in the stock market. It's the long-term view. It's a worldwide phenomena, and you can't neglect any aspect. And a lot of researchers tend to put their blinders on. They see what they want to see, and they don't see the entire picture. And believe me, the entire picture is so overwhelming. It takes up almost every aspect of our lives, you know. Now, you look at some of the things that incorporates, whether you want them to or not. We know that UFOs have the ability to knock out our power systems. During the big blackout of 1965, it's going back so many years now. There were UFO sightings up along the electrical grid in Syracuse. I remember one of the fellows I interviewed on the telephone at the time was I think they call him a sexton. He worked in the church, you know, more like a repairman or something. And his hobby was that of amateur astronomy. And he told me that for several nights in a row before the big blackout occurred, he had seen these fireballs in the sky. In fact, he sent me photographs of these. This never made the New York Times. It didn't make the press. I did write about it in one of my books, I think, Strange Encounters. But there were hundreds of people that had seen something strange in the sky up around this area near, I think it was Niagara Falls or Syracuse, where the power of the blackout, which I think put something like 35 million people into total darkness, and lasted for about a day and a half, actually started. There are, of course, the sightings around nuclear power plants, whatever that means, over nuclear missile sites as well, where these things actually seem to have the ability to knock out our radar equipment, and also to even knock our nuclear weapons offline. There are also the cattle mutilations. There are various spiritual and psychic aspects that we've just described. There's the people who claim that they've had actual contact with beings or have been abducted. And a lot of the people in the UFO field just see what they want to see. They come up with a conclusion, and they go after what they feel is the evidence that verifies their belief system. And you can't do this. You got to take off the blinders, and you got to look at it in the broadest sense possible. And I think possibly that I'm one of the few people who have done that, because I've been looking at this, and I've met most of the people involved, and I've interviewed dozens of people that have had all sorts of experience. And I've done this more or less as a journalist, I would say. You know, my background is that of a publisher, not only just of UFOs, but I was a stringer for quite a number of the tabloids like the Inquirer and the National Star when it was just starting out. I wrote most of their UFO stories, and I edited magazines like UFO Universe for 12 years and put out a newspaper called the UFO Review, and got about 209 books under my belt. So I see where this is kind of coming from. And there's more to it than really meets the eye. It's part of the physical environment of the planet. It's here, and we have very little control over it, and I don't think anybody does. And that's why we talk about disclosure. Well, there's never going to be any disclosure, Kevin, because what is the government going to disclose? How can they go on TV, at night and have a press conference and say, well, this encompasses everything from politics to religion to everything. You know, I mean, you just cannot explain this to the average person who's more interested in playing a Nintendo and watching sports or something. Nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying it takes a certain veneer to get into this in a strong, tough hide to continue with it. And a lot of people do get very frustrated and drop out because they think that they're going to read a couple of books and maybe analyze a couple of photographs and they're going to have the solution, when there is no simple solution. It's a lot more complicated than even you and I can begin to imagine.
I agree with what you just said. And I would go a step further. Just as I say that UFOs are not a religious matter, And this is not something new to my audience. They've heard me say this. And I will tell you, Timothy, not everybody in my audience, not everybody listening, agrees with that. They like the show. They listen to the show. They strongly disagree with that view of mine. But, of course, on this show, they're free to express their view. I not only do I think UFOs are not a religious matter, I don't think they are a matter of science. And let me explain why.
Absolutely. And, you know, people always say, well, you know, a lot of the things that you publish or you talk about take away credibility from the subject and the science. Because of that, the people, the scientists, are going to look the other way, or they're going to continue to ridicule the subject. They're going to continue to ridicule the subject and a lot of subjects. It doesn't matter if it's UFOs. It doesn't matter if it's archaeology. Anything that they haven't been trained to believe in, they're going to ridicule, because their jobs and their profession to a large degree depends on that.
Oh, yeah, their retirement depends on it. But
yeah,
see, the thing about science is this.
I think the true thinkers of today, we don't really have any true thinkers of today. I don't believe that anybody in a position of power today is really anybody with any great intelligence. And I hate to say that, but I look at the world as it passes by, pretty much as an observer on a daily basis, and I say, gee whiz, where's the wit, where's the humor, where's the intelligence? There doesn't seem very much of it coming from any direction.
The reason science is inadequate is because it would be the same thing as if, let's say that what you've got in your toolkit, your actual tools that you can work with, is a Phillips head screwdriver and a set of metric sockets and a ratchet wrench. And you go to a job that requires not metric but imperial measurement sockets. It doesn't require a Phillips head screwdriver. It requires a flathead screwdriver. You don't have the tools to do that job. I don't think science, as we know science here as humans, I don't think science has the tools in its toolkit to even begin to grapple with the UFO phenomena. Now, it is possible, though, that over these many decades, that a select group of scientists have been exposed, it is possible that they have been exposed to extraterrestrial science that has elevated them beyond the earthly toolkit. And they may, that small select group may be able to grapple with UFOs a little bit and understand it a little bit. But I don't think they've got the tools. I really don't. I mean, you know, this whole idea of the speed of light is the fastest speed there is. You can't go faster than the speed of light. What utter nonsense. The speed of light is what it is. And we can see it because it has slowed down enough to get into our sensory range. Infrared light is beyond our sensory range. And ultraviolet light beyond our sensory range. But the speed of light is matter that has slowed down enough for us to be able to sense it. And there are speeds much greater than the speed of light. The speed of dark is greater than the speed of light. That's why it's dark. It's outrunning the light. So our science is still trying to figure out, can we travel at the speed of light? Can we get to the speed of light? Our science is still trying to grapple with that. So they're trying to get up to the minimum speed on the galactic or on the cosmic freeway. I don't think they've got the tools in their kit to handle UFOs.
And, you know, too, Kevin, from speaking with people every people in the military. I mean, people that I've met, you know, socially from all walks of life, and I do tend to get around, or I certainly did in years past, maybe a little bit more so than today. You know, I think if you quiz the... Well, I've met people in the military, example, who were a big believer in this, and a lot of them thought that they were, you know, from outer space. Some of them realized that there may be something more paranormal here. And if you fill the Pentagon, you know, with the 50 military officials, well, officially they would tell you that there's no such thing as UFOs, that they can all be explained. But individually, if you spoke to them, they'd all have their own conclusions and own beliefs. So nobody can get together on this, not even those that are in a position of power. I don't believe that there's anybody or very few people in any position in the government or in the military who really does know what's going on. They have the same data available to them as you and I do. Unless there's some body and some bodies, I should say, and a freezer somewhere, you know, like Jackie Gleason purportedly was shown these little beings by President Nixon. Unless there's some little creature, but even if there are creatures, what do the creatures tell us, right? I mean, like, okay, so there's a body or two maybe floating around. I'm not even sure that that's necessarily the case. But what does that tell us? I mean, it doesn't tell us very much of anything. When you consider that there are hundreds of thousands of reports of UFOs, one body or two bodies here or there, it doesn't really enhance your conclusion except to say, they're not us. Unless they have an identifying tag on, and even then, you can't believe what these little guys tell you, because they'll often throw you off off the mark. They concoct just like the elementals, the little leprechauns in fairies and days past. These UFO beings can concoct quite a story. They can tell you, if you want to believe that they're from Venus, they'll tell you that. If you want to believe that they're from the inner Earth, you can find evidence that of that, too. So you can't really trust what these guys are, what these beings are thinking, because you really don't know the underlying factors.
All right, we have to step away for a break. I think that means that the other civilizations loaded all their politicians on a spaceship and sent them here. They can't tell the truth. We'll be back right after this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Tim Beckley, Timothy Green Beckley. Timothy, as we went to break, I said, it sounds to me like some other civilization must have loaded up all their politicians, put them on a spaceship, and sent them here because they can't tell us the truth.
Boy, you said that right. Well, you know, Kevin, also, too, another thing that I've come to conclude here is that... The UFOs, and I'm talking about this energy or intelligence behind it, they don't care what you or I believe. But I do think that they want us to accept their existence because in thought there is a great deal of power. Now, the Tibetan monks, are you familiar with the term the topra?
Yes.
Where you can actually... provide, if enough people think about something or provide enough energy, you can make the being or the entity even more powerful and even more real. And I think this intelligence wants us to talk them up, and it doesn't much matter to them whether you claim that you saw a light out your window or you say that you were abducted by extraterrestrials or you maintain that you had a physical encounter in the desert. because it's the energy, we're giving them energy and we're giving them life, I think, to a great deal of and allowing them to come into our realm of being. So maybe they need to come here for something. There seems to be some evidence, and we talk about the negative aspect, animal mutilations, coming here to get animal parts. They've also been involved perhaps even in blood sacrifices and in human mutilations over the centuries. So I think it's necessary for them, for us to think about them, not necessarily in a positive light or a negative sense, but the more that we think about them and the more that we dwell on the subject, the more power it gives to them. It's kind of like what Aleister, you know, Crowley was involved in the physical magic and so forth.
Well, I almost agree with that. I would modify it this way. I don't think that when I gain information about something, that gives that something more power than it already has. In many cases, by gaining the information, I take some of its power away. I think what it gives power is when people respond to information, whether they think it's positive or negative, and they respond to it emotionally, and they start believing. That's where you're investing power in something. I have a little saying that I say on this show all the time. Powerful people are only as powerful as the rest of us let them be. If the entire United States stood up and said no, if the whole population stood up on some law, some bill, and just said no, that's it. It's a done deal. Put a fork in it. It's over. That law's unenforceable. It has no power. Okay. Now, that's a theoretical. It's a hypothetical. But it explains what I'm talking about. So some people see a UFO and respond emotionally and sort of emotionally begin to bow down to this thing and, oh, they're wonderful. Some people see a UFO and they think, because of their religious background, oh, this is all evil, this is of Satan, and so they have a fear response to it. Anytime you have an emotional response to this or to anything else, you've invested power in it. It has a degree of power over you directly proportional to the amount of emotion you invested in it. Now, that's what I think.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that there is some other... I mean, when you go through history, and not just taking UFOs, but overwhelming, you know, paranormal experiences in themselves, there just has to be... well, this TV show, Ancient Aliens, for example, I mean, offers all sorts of proof that this unseen... intelligence has been with us since the beginning of time. It was created either alongside of us or perhaps was even here before we were. And they inhabit the same space that we do, but are unseen except under very unusual circumstances. And they have the ability to come and go here perhaps a little bit more than we have the ability to go there. But there have been cases, of course, where people supposedly maybe have traveled through time slips. I remember a couple of incidences. One was told to me by a fellow who was a jewelry salesman from Israel. In fact, he was an Orthodox Jew. Had no interest in UFOs or anything along that line, and was very puzzled and perturbed by all of this. Apparently, he was driving in Israel, after sunset, and it got to be very, very foggy out, and he kind of lost his way. And he was carrying with him, I guess, a satchel of diamonds Often the diamond salesmen bring the diamonds with them, and they leave them with the people, other salesmen, usually, I guess, in the wholesale business, on approval. And then they pick them up, you know, at a future date. And he had, was carrying some jewelry that had been, you know, left to him under these circumstances. And when he got home, and I guess the next day he was, you know, looking at whatever diamonds he had been giving them, appraising them, he noticed that a couple of them had vanished. They had simply disappeared, and frankly, he was afraid. I mean, how do you explain that you got, you know, maybe $30,000 worth of diamonds that you've been trusted to, and they're not there? So he didn't know what to do. Did I have, and like I say, he drove into this fog bank. There was some other, there was some missing time involved in this, and he wanted to know what it was all about. So, you know, what I told him was, I said, you know, I've heard of stories like this before, previously, where things would disappear, often associated with a UFO encounter. In fact, there was a member of my family who also had a similar experience as this. Their a particular home was being invaded by UFOs, by poltergeists, which seemed to start just after a UFO encounter that they had. I said, in a lot of these cases, the missing item will show up later on under the most unusual circumstances in a place where you least expect it. Sure enough, months went by, and I finally got a call from this same individual, and he said, oh, you know, I'm so lucky to be alive because this thing disappeared, but just like you told me, I found it. I can't remember, Kevin, the circumstances that he found the item under, but it just turned up. Now, in fact, it seems to me that one of the astronauts left a fountain pen or something on the moon, and maybe it was Edgar Mitchell. I don't remember the exact story, but later on it ended up in the premises of Uri Geller, as if it had teleported through time and space. And that's another thing that seems to be a very similarity between psychic phenomena and UFOs, is the ability to be visible, the ability to teleport objects. It's bizarre, but it's all part and parcel of the UFO phenomena. And frankly, it makes it a lot more interesting just to think that there are, a few craft coming here from somewhere else.
I wish we had more time, Tim. We don't. We're out of time. Ladies and gentlemen, Timothy Beckley, you want to be sure and click his picture on my website. It will take you to his website. If you're not on my website, remember this, conspiracyjournal.com. All right? Timothy, stay on the line with me for just a moment as we bring this flight of the Kevin Smith Show in for a landing. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.